Okay. First, I wanted to express my thanks to Sir John and to Sir Jan and to all the participants for what's been a really, really, for me, hugely enjoyable, hugely productive occasion. And we're reaching the end of the day. I'll try to be brief. This should be very simple and completely non-controversial, so. Of course. Okay, my thought in trying to comply with Jan's request was, okay, what would I bring to contemporary discussions of Majemica? A dose, but a very small dose of Wittgenstein. I came up at a time when there were still ordinary language philosophers running around in the environment. That was a dark, dark chapter in 20th century analytic philosophy. We outgrew that. It's going to be a very small dose, I promise. But I did actually begin the kind of stuff I'm doing. I trace my beginnings to actually, one day, this was June or July of 1965, that's how old I am. I was 18, I think, sitting under a tree outside Banneker Library at Columbia, reading Wittgenstein's Blue Book, and having the thought occur to me that, in fact, maybe there is another way of establishing this strange Buddhist thing called non-self, besides the sorts of stuff that I'd been previously exposed to through the writings of people like Suzuki and Watts and so on, which was what was available then. Okay, so the problem that I'm going to be prescribing a very small dose of Wittgenstein for has the following diagnosis. First of all, I understand Indian Majemica as a form of anti-realism, and by that I mean something that rejects a robust account of correspondence theory of truth. What kind of account of truth might a Majemica have in mind, even if they don't actually articulate a theory of truth? Well, I think Tom Tillemans has now convinced me that the best way to go here is deflationism. Lots of people want, and I in fact dabbled in this at one time myself, want to ascribe some sort of coherence account of truth to Majemica. I now think that's probably not the right way to go. But being a deflationist about truth, being, for instance, a disquotationalist who claims that the truth predicate is nothing more than a device for referring to what was said, this brings with it two difficulties. First, it flattens truth and thereby makes it difficult to explain how it is that widely shared beliefs could in fact be wrong. And this is something that we addressed yesterday. The basic idea I have in mind here is, okay, the Abhidharmakas address this problem by precisely introducing a distinction between two truths, two different kinds of truth. The difficulty, if you're going to be a reductionist, and I'm thinking of reductionism as precisely a way of accomplishing this, giving a proper explanation of why every sane being on the planet, it seems, is committed to a view that turns out on the view of a very small minority to be wrong. Explaining how that's possible involves paying some sort of alethic compliment to the view that is being rejected. And you do this with theory of two truths, ultimate truth and mere conventional truth. But in order to do that, you need a truth predicate that can, in fact, take modifiers. And I think that a disquotationalist or minimalist or deflationist account of truth gets in the way of that. But there's a second problem as well, which is Ma Jiangli seemed to be committed to this notion that all conceptualization falsifies, but guess what? That creates a paradox, because the statement, all conceptualization falsifies, is itself an instance of conceptualization, and so if it's true, it's false. Now, here are some possible ways of dealing with those problems. First problem would be to embrace personalism, because personalism says, well, okay, the widely shared belief that there is a me is in fact true. It's just one of those views that you can't hook up with other widely held views. It's avyakrita with respect to talk of the skandhas. And actually lots of people like to claim that that's exactly what Madhyamakas do, that they in fact reintroduce the subject of person properties. Difficulty with that is this is obviously incompatible with what I take to be Madhyamaka commitments to the non-self project as central, as essential to Buddhism. One way of evading the second problem, the prapancha paradox, is to embrace dialetheism. Yeah, okay, it's paradoxical, so what? It's true. Difficulty with that, well, I see two, actually. One, if we're trying to be true to the texts and the authors of those texts, here what I principally have in mind is Nagarjuna and his commentators. They are logically conservative. They are not prepared to embrace a non-classical logic. I also think that this leads to problems in the deployment of prasangas, and we talked a little bit about that earlier today. But here is my suggestion. Here's where the dose of Wittgenstein comes in. What Wittgenstein in his later phase is up to is, one way of characterizing it, is giving much greater weight to pragmatics, to paying it. We should pay attention to what we're actually doing when we use language. And one way of, one possible outcome of that is radical contextualist semantics. To be a radical contextualist semanticist is to take this central claim of the later Wittgenstein, this proposal, think of meaning as use, to take that slogan seriously. If you take it really seriously, then that begins to erode the distinction between semantics and pragmatics. When you take it in a truly radical form, where it takes you is to this idea that it's only in some context of use that a sentence has meaning. This is what I mean by eroding the pragmatics-semantics distinction. Usually in philosophy of language and in linguistics, we distinguish between a theory of meaning and a theory of what one does in the use of expressions with that meaning, pragmatics. But a radical contextualist semantics, I think, has the consequence that that distinction no longer holds. What a radical contextualist semantics is doing is generalizing from something that, from a phenomenon that we all recognize, which is use of terms like demonstrative or indexicals. If I said that tree was struck by lightning yesterday, in order to understand my utterance, you need to have a certain bit of knowledge about the context of my utterance. You have to, first of all, attend to which tree it is that I am demonstrating, that I'm pointing to. And you also have to know what day today is in order to understand my use of the expression yesterday, okay? So to understand that sentence, because the sentence contains a demonstrative and an indexical, you need to have knowledge about the context of utterance. Radical contextualist semantics is extending that idea to a computation of the meaning of every sentence, okay? Now, why think that? Well, I'm not going to go into the evidence. In fact, it's hugely complicated. I'm not sure I've got my head completely around it. The go-to person for this is François Recanati. And I'll give you his, what just happened? Truth Conditional Pragmatics. Much of the evidence that he cites has to do with phenomena of both top-down and bottom-up computation of meaning. So we need to look at the sentence frame to compute the meanings of individual words. We obviously need to work from the individual words to compute the sentence as a whole, the sentence frame. It goes in both directions. I won't go through examples. But I think we can also get an intuitive sense of what's going on here if we think about how we understand Sanskrit compounds. Because, as Matthias was just pointing out, we have a variety of different kinds of Sanskrit compounds. There's an elaborate theory of them. But when it comes to deciding what is the meaning of this particular compound occurring in this sentence, we have to not just look at the individual words that make up the compound, we need to look at the other words in the sentence in order to get some sort of idea of what the context might have been, what the speaker's intentions might have been, in order to decide, is this a kamadaya, tatpurusha, bhavi, whatever. Is it a dvanda? Might be a dvandva. So there, too, we have top-down and bottom-up computations involved, and it looks like there is no way of doing all the computations that are required without, in fact, at least imagining, if not bringing in, knowledge of context. Okay. And now, I do want to make what I'm suggesting here something that might conceivably be acceptable to a 6th century, 7th century Madhyamaka. So it's nice if there's anything I can point to in the tradition, in the corpus, that might actually connect up with this, and the obvious way to go is the distinction between neartha and nitartha in order to understand the Buddha's discourses on this or that occasion. You need to know whom he was addressing and what his intentions were given whom he was addressing. The neartha texts, those are the ones where, from what we know about the audience and the Buddha's intentions, we know we have to do some interpreting, okay? This is not to be taken literally. Okay, but now here's the real punch that comes from radical contextualist semantics. I call it NT. There are no truth bearers outside a context of assertion. Okay, ordinarily we think words express a proposition, and a proposition is an entity that is a truth bearer, and it is at the same time an eternal. It's one of those third realm entities, something that exists in all three times. Okay. Well, outside a context of assertion, according to radical contextualist semantics, a word string does not have meaning. It does not express a proposition, and so it cannot, in fact, be true or false. Okay, and that's the key takeaway from radical contextual semantics for my purposes here. Okay, now let me say a word about what I think is going on when we make an assertion. When we do so, I think we are committed to this presupposition that there are things with svabhava, with intrinsic nature. Here's why I say that. Suppose, okay, we're having discussion about how we should manufacture bows for this great new sport called archery. And we're debating what kind of material to use. And someone says plastic, and someone says metal. I say, no, wood. Wood's the perfect thing. When I make that assertion, I am representing myself as willing to and able to respond to challenges to my assertion. And here are some possible responses. And someone says, well, why do you say that, Sidorus? What do you know about? What do you know from bows and arrows? Well, I say, that's just the way wood is. Okay, that's one possible response. And we can, in fact, imagine a context in which that would count as an appropriate response. But I might, in a slightly different context, say, oh, but sure, wood is that way, but it's that way because wood just is strands of cellulose. And cellulose has this property that explains why wood is the perfect material for making a bow. It's flexible, it has all sorts of interesting properties. And yet, here's yet another thing I might say. I may say, well, yeah, wood is just strands of cellulose, but cellulose just is a large array of hydrocarbon molecules, and a hydrocarbon molecule has the following nature. Okay? Now, each of these responses implicitly attributes svabhava to something or other. In the first case, it's implicitly attributing svabhava. In fact, it's explicit. It says wood just is that way. It just has that flexibility or whatever the relevant property is. In the second case, it's saying, well, yeah, wood just is cellulose, and cellulose has such and such a property that explains why wood is perfect. And third, we're down to the level of hydrocarbon molecules. So in 2 and 3, we've got analysis involved. In 1, there is no analysis. But in each case, in each of those assertions, I am presupposing that there is a bottom level. There is something that makes this the right choice, that makes my answer the correct one. Now, if Majjhimikas are right, then that presupposition is false in each case. Or at least that's what each of those assertions seems to involve. I am implicitly presupposing something that Majjhimikas claim is false. But now, according to radical contextualist semantics, given NT, there is nothing that is true outside some concrete context of utterance. Each of those three sentences is the sort of thing that could be true or false only in some concrete context of utterance. Okay? There are no such things as timelessly existing propositions that are either true or false. But now, suppose further that for something to count as a context of assertion, there must be facts about the utterer, the speaker, and the audience that determine what counts as bottom level, what counts as now we've reached bedrock. And the bedrock metaphor here is bringing in Wittgenstein's uncertainty, so a little bit more of our small dose of Wittgenstein. Then, okay, two results from this, from putting NT together with my proposal S. First, truth is no longer flattened. And second, there is no paradox generated by P. Okay, why is truth not flattened? Why does truth get reinflated? Because remember that what we're looking at here is a deflationist account of truth, which I claim flattens it. That's what happens when you let all the air out of your air mattress or your tire. Well, flattening comes by way of the claim that since nothing has intrinsic nature, analysis can never reach an end. So assertions like 2 and 3, which presuppose that they have, well, okay, leave out the presuppositions, they both show that 1 is false.
What 2 and 3 were, Mark? I forgot what 2 and 3 were.
What's 2 and 3?
Where 2 is cellulose and 3 was.
Wood just is flexible. Wood just is cellulose, and cellulose is such and such a way. Okay? And yeah, you got wood is the thing with the level at which there is svabhava, you got cellulose, the level at which there is svabhava, and you got hydrocarbon molecules as the level at which there is svabhava. Okay. Now, it looks like what we're doing when we go from 1 to 2 to 3 is showing that, in fact, 2 relative to 1 is a more accurate representation of reality. Okay, and so we're back to robust correspondence. But here's the thing. In the context of utterance in which 1 would be said to be true, it is true. That word string uttered in the context of utterance in which 2 would be the right thing to say, namely the context where I know stuff about cellulose, other people, my audience knows stuff about cellulose. You know, think of us as not exactly, I don't know what, material scientists, not chemical engineers, material scientists. And, you know, we know stuff about materials like cellulose, okay? The part of 2 that contains stuff about 1, I mean, okay. Relational word string. What we're really doing in 2 is. What we've now got is a way of doing reduction without commitment to ultimately real entities with svabhava. Radical contextualist semantics allows for a domesticated version of the distinction between conventional and ultimate truth. Okay, that's the claim. That's what I'm trying to do by bringing radical contextual semantics in. See, the problem, the flattening problem, is precisely the problem that it seems to rule out the possibility of there being two assertions about a certain situation that could each in their own context be correct, and yet one be represented in a certain context as a mere approximation to what the other is asserting. Okay? So what you get then is a way of reintroducing the notion of the relation between a mere loose and popular way of talking as opposed to a philosophically respectable way of talking, you reintroduce that without bringing back in the serious ontology of a Dharma theory, of a theory of ultimately real entities, things with svabhava. That's the basic idea. Okay, the other thing it does, I claim, is it dissolves the paradoxicality of the statement P, which is all conceptualization falsifies. The basic problem here is that P, it turns out, doesn't, if you accept radical contextual semantics, P is neither true nor false. It does not express a statement. In order for it to count as a statement, it requires context-transcendent truth conditions. And according to radical contextual semantics, there is no such thing, there are no such things as context-transcendent truth conditions. Outside of a context, a word string fails to express a proposition, fails to have meaning. So P is, in fact, meaningless. So if it's meaningless, it fails to generate a paradox. And this, by the way, is something that, I mean, this approach to paradoxes is one that's actually orthodox in the Indian tradition. Bhartrhari pioneered this with his discussion of the liar paradox. His basic response to that was, no one would ever say that. Okay? No one would ever say it, bringing pragmatics in, and why would anyone say, everything I say is false? And since no one would ever say it, we don't need to worry because, in fact, it doesn't have any meaning.
Okay? How wrong can you be? This is Kripke's Dean and Nixon case, which were asserted.
Okay. Now, in the case of P, the strategy might be a little bit more successful. What it's really doing is generalizing from particular instances, like what happens when we go from 1 to 2, or we go from 2 to 3. Okay, in each of those moves, we show that the presupposition that we were making in the earlier context is false. Now, you can go on and do the same, perform the same prasanga on, it seems, well, you can do it on 3, and you can do it on 4, and 5, and so on. You just keep going. In each case, you do it by bringing in a new context. What you cannot do, according to radical contextual semantics, is generalize, do the universal generalization that we seem to be invited to perform when we say, well, all conceptualization falsifies. That's the mistake. All conceptualization falsifies is just a quick and dirty way of trying to say what can actually only be shown by doing the hard work of one after another, and then hoping that eventually your interlocutor, the person you're talking to, will actually get the point and stop reifying. Okay? So this is standard prasangika technique. Okay? That's where I think radical contextualist semantics takes you. And this, I think, actually helps show how Majjhimaka anti-realism can, in fact, be a kind of anti-realism that lots of us can live with a whole lot better. Okay. Metaphysical realism obviously turns on the notion of there being verification transcendent truth conditions. The garden variety anti-realisms that we're familiar with, those of people like Putnam and Dummett and Rorty and so on, these all involve imposing verification, verifiability constraints. And the standard criticism of all of those anti-realisms is precisely that they are guilty of, Mark Johnston's phrase, a kind of epistemological narcissism, basically tailoring our ontology to the limits of our knowledge. Well, a deflationist majemica could say that, okay, you don't need to embrace verificationism to be an anti-realist. Just embrace radical contextual semantics instead. And what you get is local correspondence. You get something like a correspondence theory of truth, which is what was objectionable about the two truths theory for majomicus. The ultimate truth has to be robust correspondence, has to be isomorphism between statement and state of affairs. You get a local version of that. Okay, what the two truths theory was trying to do was show how the folk could be right in their own limited way. You get, in other words, what Lademan calls vindication, not elimination. That's what reduction gives you. How the folk could be right in their own limited way and yet fall short of real table-pounding truth. Only this way you don't have the table-pounding because it's understood all to be contextualized. Okay, so, thank you.